So, welcome to the Sutta class. So this is I started last week doing the Sabhasava Sutta, which is the second sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. So I'm going to continue with that sutta today. So, just to recap very briefly, the Sabhasava Sutta is the sutta about all the taints. And taint here is like any kind of problem in the mind, like a corruption or a poisoning or a pollution in the mind. These are the taints. So this is then basically a sequence of exercises or sequence of practices how to overcome these particular taints. And the sutta starts off with overcoming the taint. It's called the method of overcoming taints by seeing. And seeing here basically means insight. So the very first one here is basically how to become a stream enter, how to become an Arya. And it's interesting that the sutta actually starts with that, because what that means is that the rest of the path of practice, it takes the idea of being an Arya, a noble person, as a foundation. And then the rest is then leading up to full awakening. And I think the reason why it is like that is because once you have seen the Dhamma, once you are a stream enter, then the path is basically automatic, right? So then the path follows as a consequence of that. That doesn't mean that it's impossible to practice if you haven't become a stream enter. It just means that once you reach that stage, the path is automatic, and prior to that, it's not quite as automatic, essentially. Can you hear me properly? Should I go a bit closer? I'm not sure if I'm doing the right thing here. If not doing the right thing, please let me know so I can adjust the mic or whatever here. So then once you have abandoned the taints by seeing, then there are six other methods that come after that. And these six other methods, these are then like the rest of the path that follows on afterwards. So this is like, what you can see here is like an aspect of the gradual training, right? The gradual training in the suttas is the training that happens when you start off on the Buddhist path all the way to awakening. That's the gradual training. It's one of the most important kind of system that are laid out in the suttas in terms of what you're supposed to do and how you're supposed to practice. And this then is a similar kind of thing. And when you look at the various aspects here, you can actually see the gradual training in these seven ways of abandoning these asavas. And the next one after seeing is abandoning by restraining. And if you know a little bit about the suttas, you know that restraining is usually an aspect of right effort. So right effort is then the sixth factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, right? So you can also compare this to the Noble Eightfold Path. Straight away after seeing, you actually arrive at the sixth factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, which is right effort. So why is it that you go straight from insight to the sixth factor? What happens with all the factors in between? What about, you know, the virtue factors, right action, right speech, right livelihood? What about right intention? And the point is that because the sutta starts off with seeing, because you're already a stream enter, then the virtue is already purified at that point. Once you are a stream enter, your virtue is purified. So the virtue factors sort of fall by the wayside when you start at this kind of high level here. That's one reason why sense restraint is coming up next. Another way of looking at it is to understand that sense restraint is almost like the culmination of the virtue. So you can somehow probably also understand that sense restraint in a sense includes other aspects of virtue in it as well. And then we will see as we go along here that all the remaining factors also kind of fit in quite nicely into the Noble Eightfold Path until you reach right samadhi at the very end there. So that is just a quick recap of what we have done so far. Now I will start. Have you got any new copies of this sutta? Would you like a copy of the sutta? Maybe what we can do. I'm not sure what we can do. She does, yeah. Maybe she has gone to do it, yes. Yeah. Okay. Well, let's just see what happens. But if Lynn comes back, we can ask her, unless, you know, if she doesn't bring anything in. So, okay. Okay, so then we come to sense restraint. And this is a very important part as well of the Buddhist practice. And it is something which may not always be understood very well, what this actually means. So I'll read out this second way of abandoning the taints, and then I'll explain it afterwards. So it goes like this. What taint, bhikkhus, should be abandoned by restraining? Here, a bhikkhu reflecting wisely abides with the eye faculty restrained, while taints, vexation, and fever might arise in one who abides with the eye faculty unrestrained, there is no taint, vexation, and fever in one who abides with the eye faculty restrained. Reflecting wisely, he abides with the ear faculty restrained, with the nose faculty restrained, with the tongue faculty restrained, with the body faculty restrained, with the mind faculty restrained, while taints, vexations, and fever might arise in one who abides with any of these unrestrained, there are no taints, vexations, and fever in one who abides with the faculties restrained. These are called the taints that should be abandoned by restraining here. And the first thing to notice here, which is interesting, this gives you a fairly clear idea of what the meaning of taint is, because here it is used in juxtaposition with vexation and fever. And of course, vexation and fever is like, you know, a fevered mind is like a mind which is maybe angry or has a lot of desire. It's like a fever inside of you. You feel kind of hot or whatever. So the taint here is very similar in quality to these words, fever and vexation. In other words, like troubles and problems or corruptions or defilements, etc. That gives you some idea what it actually means. Now this formula here of sense restraint is quite interesting. It's a bit different from the normal formulas for sense restraint. So the first thing which I think is interesting here is what is meant by the word restraint, or is the word restraint a good rendering of the Pali in this particular case? And when I hear the word restraint, I always think of restraint as like holding somebody back. It's like an idea of physical force, perhaps, or certainly of using willpower. So there's some very forceful aspect to restraint. You restrain somebody from going somewhere. It's like you use force very often. And that is an important to understand that that is not necessarily the meaning in this particular case. Restraint here does not necessarily mean like physical force or using willpower. And this is one of those things that you have to be very careful when you read the suttas, because sometimes if the translation isn't very careful, it can give you the wrong idea in English. So one of the things I want to look at here is what actually restraining actually means in this particular context. And to get that idea, the text then continues. Here, a bhikkhu, reflecting wisely, he abides with the eye faculty restrained. So reflecting wisely. And this here is one of the clues that tells you what actually is meant by restraint in this particular case. In other places where the restraint of the senses in mention, it often talks about guarding the eye faculty, rakkati is in the Pali. And guarding always has this idea of mindfulness accompanying it. When you guard something in Buddhism, you guard your eyes, you guard your mind, that guarding happens with mindfulness, right? It's mindfulness that tells you what you're doing, what's happening around you. So the first aspect of restraining is always mindfulness. You have to be mindful about what is going on. Only when you know what's happening inside of your senses and your mind is it possible to restrain. So knowledge and that understanding of mindfulness is the first thing. And of course, initially, when you start off on the Buddhist path, your mindfulness may not be very strong. It may still be developing. And so one of the things that you find sometimes in the suttas is that mindfulness and sense restraint, they are often used in different position relative to each other. Sometimes you find sense restraint first. Actually, that's the usual way. Sense restraint first, and then mindfulness arises as a result of sense restraint. But other times you find that mindfulness comes first, and then sense restraint come afterwards. And the reason for that is because these two qualities, they actually revolve around each other. So as you learn to restrain rightly, your mindfulness gets more established. as your mindfulness gets more established, your ability to restrain, your ability to see the defilements increases. So it's like two things working together and building each other up. So mindfulness is one of the factors that actually makes sense restraint possible. And when mindfulness really is properly established, when you really are in the present moment, when you are properly aware of things that are going on, it's only then that sense restraint really becomes properly purified and becomes like a power in your practice. So sense restraint, which is fully established, only happens when mindfulness is fully established. So that is the first thing to remember about restraint. It can only happen with mindfulness. And I'm sure you will see that in your daily life. Sometimes you will be aware of your emotions and feelings. You will see what's happening in your mind. Other times you will kind of go on automatic and you're not really clear about what's going on. So you would see there the degree to which you're actually able to be aware of your own mental states. But that is not enough. Mindfulness obviously is important, but it's not enough. Because one thing is being aware that something is happening inside of you. But the other aspect is you have to do something about it, right? Just awareness is never enough in its own right. The other aspect is, well, what do I do with this thing once I'm aware of it? And this is where the idea of restraining comes in. So most people, when they do this practice, because they read a formula like this, they think, okay, I'm aware of it, and then I kind of hold it back. I restrain the mind from going to those places where defilements might arise. So I stop it from, you know, from desire from arising or from anger from arising by holding the mind back with force. That is the kind of usual way that people understand this particular formula. This is what I did when I started off. And sometimes the formula uses even stronger language. It says like, you know, you we'll see that later on actually, you annihilate something, you terminate it and you obliterate it. These kind of words that you used, particularly in translation, which gives us an idea, again, of using a lot of willpower in your practice. But the clue here to understand what you're actually supposed to do once you have sufficient mindfulness to recognize something is this term, reflecting wisely. This is the clue here. And reflecting wisely, it can be translated also differently from this. It doesn't have to be translated in this way. Another way is to understand as having reflected wisely. In other words, it's not necessarily simultaneous with, you know, with the restraint. It can actually be prior to it. In fact, it's both. It's both prior to it and simultaneous with it. So reflecting wisely here means having reflected wisely and reflecting wisely at the time. So what is that wise reflection that you have to do? And the wise reflection, because you want to avoid using too much force in your practice, because force is always painful and it never really works unless you use force for a while and you get tired and then you relax and then the defilements come back again. So force is really like a last resort. You want to use wisdom if at all possible. And this is what wisely reflecting is about here, using wisdom. So what you need to do to be able to do this is that you need to understand the danger in these things, the danger in allowing craving, a desire to arise, or anger and negative states to arise. This is really the clue. You have to understand that these things are going to lead to trouble. They're going to lead to suffering. And you have to understand that in as deep a way as you possibly can. The more deeply you understand that anger is a real problem, that it leads to suffering for yourself and for others in this life, in future life, it leads to all kinds of problems in society. The more deeply you can understand that issue, the more easy it is to say, stop, I don't want to go there, when something is about to arise in your mind. So that is the clue. So actually reflect on these things and do that on a fairly regular basis to remind yourself why these things should be avoided. And you find that in the suttas, I was a few months ago, I think it was before the rains retreat, I was talking about the Dveda Vitakka Sutta, which is Majjhima 19, two kinds of thought. And in there, that sutta, the Buddha divides thinking up into kind of the bad thinking, desire and anger on the one hand, and then the good thinking like metta and renunciation and compassion on the other. And then he explains quite clearly why the bad thinking is bad. And he says that, you know, it leads to suffering for yourself now and in the future. And that is something very worthy of reflecting on. Anger always leads to problems. Sooner or later, if you have anger, you're going to act on it. You're going to say something which is nice. You're going to do something which is nicer. That's just the way anger works. It's painful right here and now. It doesn't feel very good. And one of the things what he says in that, which to me is very powerful, he says that it makes wisdom cease. If you're angry, wisdom ceases. You have no wisdom anymore. You lose your ability to see things straight. And of course, I think a lot of people who are either practicing Buddhist or have an interest in Buddhism, they recognize that wisdom is one of those qualities that is really beautiful and really worth having. This is one reason why we're here, to have some wisdom, right? To understand how to live in the world, how to live in harmony, how to live at peace, how to be able to have happiness and a sense of contentment and balance in our mind. This is one of the reasons why we live, why we come to a teaching like the Buddha's teachings. So if something makes that wisdom cease, well, certainly that is something which is completely contrary to the Buddhist path, as most of us, I think, want to practice it. So that is, to me, that is very powerful. It actually makes wisdom cease. And you can see that. The moment you're angry, if you reflect on it, you know that you're not seeing clearly anymore. You know that things get turned upside down. You know that things that you normally would never want to do, you start doing those things because it's like everything is inverted. Everything is distorted by the anger, by the negativity, irritation, or even by the desire. So this is the way to reflect. And if you are the kind of person who sometimes likes to read the suttas and you like to come here, you will come across now and again passages which describe the danger in things like anger and also in desire. There are actually several suttas right here in the Majjhima Nikaya that talk about these things. So think about that. When that comes up, look at that, because this can become a very powerful tool to use in your practice. When you remember that, when you know very strongly inside of yourself that this actually does lead to suffering for myself and others, you look at something, you can see that maybe a defilement is about to arise in your mind, your mindfulness is strong enough, you see that happening. Because you have mindfulness, you remember the teaching that is given somewhere, this is dangerous, or you remember your own kind of application of that teaching in your own life. And you see that, and because you know that straight away, you can turn away from that. And what happens at that point, because you turn away from it, it disappears straight away. It's not something that you have to restrain by force or willpower, but because you know this is dangerous territory, it just disappears, vanishes by itself. And that is the idea of using wisdom rather than willpower. It's understanding that these things are not worthy of your attention. In fact, they are dangerous and they lead to enormous amounts of problems and troubles, both now and also in the future. So this is the kind of thing which is mentee by reflecting wisely. In other words, you have reflected wisely beforehand and you have internalized the idea that this is dangerous, and now you bring that to mind when a problem is about to arise in the mind. And the same thing with desire as well. You know that excessive desire causes incredible amounts of problem for yourself and for other people as well. It's the same kind of thing. So this is what wisely reflecting means here. And we talked about this word wisely before. Wisely is yoniso in Pali. It's from the root, the word yoni, which means womb, quite literally. And womb is like a source, right? So it's going to the source. It's wise because you understand the source of things. It's like you understand causality, where something comes from. And you understand that suffering is caused by these things. And you can see that this anger and ill will, negativity is about to arise in your mind. So wisely reflecting. And then, only then, are you really able to have sense restraint in a meaningful way. And this is very useful. It's obviously very useful in monastic life, because in monastic life, the good thing about monastic life is you have a bit less business than you have in worldly life, which means that you have hopefully a bit more clarity about things. But it's also very important in daily life. You can see yourself. Sometimes you get into a situation which might be irritating or difficult. You're about to get angry. But then because you have internalized these teachings, straight away they come there. And I don't want to go down that way. It's too dangerous. It's too much suffering. I don't want to be there. So very useful. So this kind of restraint is very helpful in daily life as well, particularly for anger and negativity, irritations, etc. Perhaps not quite, it's a bit more difficult to deal with desire. Desire is more deep-rooted, but certainly for anger, etc. So that then is how you restrain these faculties, the eye faculty, the nose faculty, etc. And it's interesting also here that it says what you are restraining is not actually the eye as such, it's the eye faculty. So what's the difference, do you think, between eye and eye faculty? Well, the eye is just a physical thing, right? Restraining the eye would mean like moving the eye or closing the eye or something like that. But what you're actually restraining is not just that, it's the whole apparatus which actually sees. So it's actually the mind, right? The mind together with the eye and everything. So it's actually the mind that you're really restraining there, more than anything else. It also involves the eye, but it's the mind. This is not where I want to go, I go somewhere else. That's why it's called the eye faculty. It's like the ability to see, basically, the power of seeing. That's what you restrain in this particular case. And then you have the same thing for the other four senses, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body. And then lastly, you also have the mind faculty itself. And the mind faculty here means that you are, you know, fantasizing or thinking about something, completely independent of the senses. You remember something from the past, you have a dream perhaps or whatever it is. And that thinking process itself can then give rise to also to, you know, to anger and desire, etc., just like everything else. So that these then are, this is what is called the taints that should be abandoned by restraining. You could almost say the taints that should be abandoned by reflecting, because I think reflecting is the most important aspect here of restraint. So this, we're getting now, you can see these are very practical teachings here and very important teachings for the Buddhist path. We're getting here to work directly with the mind. And this, of course, this idea of working with the mind and developing the mind is a very Buddhist thing. So here you are very in the very heart of the Buddhist training here. Okay, so does that make sense to everybody? Anybody have any questions about that before we move on? Are you happy? Please ask questions at any time if you like. Just raise your hand or whatever, and we'll take it from there. So then comes the next section here. We have now done the taints to be abandoned by restraining. The next one are taints to be abandoned by using. And if you know how the gradual training works, the gradual training normally at this stage normally has sampajanya, which is clear comprehension. That's the normal sequence in the gradual training. But here we have abandoning by using instead of clear comprehension. So these next exercises here can be understood as basically just another way of looking at clear comprehension, really. Sampajanya, which is like sampajanya, clear comprehension, like wisdom practice in a sense. So, let's see what it says here. What taints, bhikkhu, should be abandoned by using? Here, a bhikkhu, reflecting wisely, uses the robe only for protection from cold, for protection from heat, for protection from contact with gadflies, mosquitoes, wind, the sun, and creeping things, and only for the purpose of concealing the private parts. Reflecting wisely, he uses alms food neither for amusement, nor for intoxication, nor for the sake of physical beauty and attractiveness, but only for the endurance and continuance of this body, for ending discomfort and for assisting the holy life. Considering, thus I shall terminate old feelings without arousing new feelings, and I shall be healthy and blameless and shall live in comfort. Reflecting wisely, he uses a resting place only for protection from cold, for protection from heat, for protection from contact with gadflies, mosquitoes, wind, the sun, and creeping things, and only for the purpose of warding off the perils of climate and for enjoying retreat. Wisely reflecting, he uses the medicinal requisites only for protection from arisen afflicting feelings and for the benefit of good health. While taints, vexation, and fever might arise in one who does not use the requisites thus, there are no taints, vexation, or fever in one who uses them thus. These are called the tenets that should be abandoned by using him. So here, this passage is then about the kind of the standard four requisites that you have in monastic life. You see here, you have the alms food, you have the robes, you have the resting place, which is like the hut in the forest or whatever. And then you have the medicines, which is the last one. And these are the four kind of standard requisites that you have in monastic life. So you can see that this is very much geared toward monastics. But I think a lot of the things that you see here can also be used in lay life as well. It's not just for monastics. It can also be adapted to be used in lay life. So the main point with this passage you will see here is basically that you want to use these requisites without giving rise to unwholesome states. So you want to use them in such a way that you don't give rise to craving or ill will or anger. This is what this is all about. This is why it's called sampajanya, clear comprehension. You use them for the right purpose, in a suitable way and not in an unsuitable way for the wrong purpose. That's what's going on here. So the right way then for using a robe is simply for, as it says here, protection from the cold, from heat, getting out of the sun and the wind and creeping things, and only for concealing your private parts. So it's basically, it has a very specific purpose, and you shouldn't go beyond that. And you see this very often in monastic life. You see monastics who are very interested in having certain types of robes, perhaps, or certain types of requisites. It's very, very common. Of course, in lay life, it's much more common. People are obsessed about what they look like in terms of clothes. It's extremely common. Almost everybody does it. But you find it even in monastic life, you find these things. And basically, the Buddha is saying here, this should not really be a concern at all. The robes have a certain purpose, and that purpose is just what is mentioned here, no purpose beyond that. It's not about having the right color, the right shape, the right pattern, the right fabric, and all these things. This is the purpose of these robes. And when you use them in that way, it is not going to give rise to craving. It's not going to give rise to unwholesome states. You're using the robes for the right purpose and in a suitable way. And this is exactly when you see the passage on the sampajanya that you normally find in the gradual training. The sampajanya says that you have sampajanya, you are one who has sampajanya in relation to the robes, in relation to the alms bowl, in relation to walking back and walking forth and all these things. That is what the sampajanya says. And sampajanya in that context means, according to the commentary, that you know the purpose why doing things. You're doing it for the right purpose. You know the suitable way of using that. It's called purpose and suitability. These are the two main aspects of sampajanya, purpose and suitability. And that is exactly what we're seeing here. You know the purpose of using a robe. You use it in a suitable way. You don't get carried away. So you can see that this is, in a sense, an extension of the sense restraint you saw before. The sense restraint, you make sure that you don't give rise to any unwholesome and bad states. And this is almost like a sub-factor of that. When you use the robe rightly, it is like you have a sense of restraint because you have clarity about why you are using these robes. And that clarity then stops the unwholesome states from arising. So this is clear comprehension, in a sense, in practice. This is what is meant by clear comprehension. You know why you're doing these things. And this is also, I think, applicable in lay life. Not being too overly concerned about what you wear and all these kind of things. It's applicable to everybody. Some people are obsessed about these things. Other people are pretty relaxed about clothes and that kind of stuff. So then we have the next one. This is now about eating, another big issue in monastic life when you don't have many other pleasures sometimes. And again, you can see here, you don't do it for intoxication or amusement. Of course, intoxication is like, again, when craving becomes very strong, right? You're intoxicated by the food. Then you have for the sake of physical beauty and attractiveness, which is a little bit strange for food because it's not common to eat for physical beauty and attractiveness, unless perhaps one means that you becoming nice and fat would be considered beautiful. which is true in some cultures. But in the Chinese version of the sutta, the physical beauty and attractiveness doesn't actually occur with the food. So it may be that this is actually a false application here in the Pali, and that that should go maybe with the robes instead. It's missing in the robes here, but if I remember correctly, it's actually there in the robes in the Chinese version. So that may make sense. Yes. Okay. Sure. Yeah. It could be something like that. That's something that detoxes you or helps you rejuvenate or whatever. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. It's possible. Yeah. But I think still it fits better with the clothes, in my opinion, though. You know, being beautiful or whatever. Yeah. It fits better under there. So, but it could be used in other place. So, sure. Okay, so, and then you can see why you should eat. And the only reason you should eat is for the body to endure and to continue and for ending discomfort. In other words, it's about not being uncomfortable. And that's why in monastic life too, we often have, you know, in Bodhinyana Monastery, we have a main meal, then we have a small little thing early in the morning, like a small breakfast. And then in the evening, if you need a bit of chocolate or whatever, or a cup of tea to boost your energy, you can have that in the evening. So these are all there to maintain the body, to make sure you don't actually have any fatigue or discomfort or whatever, and then to assist the living of the monastic life. So that is the purpose of the food. That is the ideal purpose. But of course, to overcome all craving for food is actually quite a high thing, even in monastic life. It takes a lot of deep meditation before you overcome these things completely. And then considering, I shall terminate old feelings, in other words, any discomfort you have or hunger you have, without arising new feelings. And this is usually understood to mean you don't overeat and, you know, feel bloated or whatever afterwards. And I shall be healthy and blameless, and I shall live in comfort. So again, this is another aspect of Sampajanya. You know how to use these requisites in such a way that it actually leads to a positive result. It doesn't actually increase the defilement, but it decreases the defilements instead. Then we have the resting place, and again, it is to be used for protection from cold, heat, and all these insects, and the wind and the sun, and for warding off the perils of climate, and for enjoying retreat, which is here, Patisalana, which is a retreat here, like seclusion, basically, for enjoying seclusion. So that is the main purpose of having a kuti, you know, in the forest, is actually to be able to enjoy seclusion, to get away from the crowds and being by yourself. And you will see in the suttas, the Buddha very often says, you know, monks, go off to an empty house, an empty dwelling somewhere, and meditate. That is where you should meditate, in an empty place. That's kind of the ideal, according to the suttas, because that is where you're most likely to be able to progress in meditation practice. So again, you don't need a fancy kuti. You need something very simple. You need something which is secluded, which gives you that seclusion. That's what you need. Something which gives you protection from the elements. That's what you need. You don't need anything fancy. And it's one of those dangers you can see in Buddhism as well, is that very often, particularly in certain places in Asia, not so much in the West, where people have so much faith sometimes and so much generosity that they build you these massive mansions for monastics. And sometimes it is it's quite silly, and it obviously doesn't serve the purpose anymore. The purpose is to have seclusion. The purpose isn't to have like a big meeting hall next to your room or whatever, but these things often happen. And then what you're doing then is actually you're starting to destroy Buddhism, because this is exactly the reason why you want a large, you know, house or whatever for yourself. That is very often based on craving. Maybe not always, but very often it's based on craving. You want to have something nice. And if lay people allow the monastics to do these kind of things, well, you're encouraging the craving. You're encouraging defilements. And I have seen some places where monks live myself that are absolutely, absolutely ridiculous, to be quite honest. And when I saw that, I asked the lay people who were there, I said to them, well, what's going on here? What's this all about? And they say, oh, yeah, we know that it's not really, but, you know, he's such a nice monk, so we don't want to ask any questions, we just want to support. And that's sometimes the kind of answers you get from lay people. But it's okay here for a lay person to have a little bit of a critical eye and say, this goes too far. This is not the right way for a monastic to live. This doesn't serve the purpose. What we're doing, if we support a person here, is that actually we're destroying Buddhism. We're not helping at all. We're bringing it down. So keep that in mind. If you give too much, if you give at the wrong time and you give in the wrong way, you can actually bring Buddhism down rather than supporting it. So this idea of generosity is not just about giving blindly, it's about giving wisely. And this is something that lay people, particularly in traditional Buddhist countries, sometimes need to take into account and think about. There is wise giving and there's just blind giving here. Anyway, so that is the kutis, or the resting places that is used for monastic. It should be simple, but do the job. And then we have here, reflecting wisely, he uses medicinal requisites. And again, these are not just kind of traditional medicines in the West, but these are kind of requisites that as a monastic you can have in the evening, like a bit of chocolate or sugar or tea and coffee and these kind of things. So you use these, again, to sustain yourself, to make sure you don't have any discomfort. In the monastic vinaya, the word that's used here is gilana. Gilana actually means illness. But illness is defined to mean any kind of discomfort you have. So that means that it's very generous and compassionate how that is actually used in the monastic vinaya. Okay, so if you do all that and you practice these things correctly, then again, you avoid the craving and the negative mind states that may arise because you are using it in an unsuitable way. And this, again, is, of course, the whole purpose of this, to move forward and not to move backward. And again, I think all of you can, I'm sure you can appreciate how this also can apply to lay life. What is important to you? How much craving do you have for all the material things in life? What is actually going on? How much do you think about such things? How much negativity and irritation do they give rise to when you don't get the things like as you would want to have them, etc., etc.? It's very parallel to monastic life, but obviously not quite as strict as in a monastic life. So that is abandoning the taints by using wisely or using things correctly. Okay, the next one here is by enduring. And of course, the point here of enduring is that no matter how well supported you are, no matter how high your income is in lay life, you're never going to have everything just the way you like it. There's always going to be a time when you have to endure problems and pains. This is just life. And if you learn to endure and you learn to sort of be able to deal with that, then you find that you can actually step back much more. And in monastic life, it's exactly the same thing. You learn that you have the requisites, and instead of thinking how you can sort of find ways of alleviating problems this way or that way, sort of tricking samsara to give you the right things, instead of doing that, you sometimes endure a little bit instead. And it isn't that much endurance that's usually required. Anyway, so this is how this passage goes. What taints, bhikkhus, should be abandoned by enduring? Here, a bhikkhu, reflecting wisely, bears cold and heat, hunger and thirst, contact with gadflies, mosquitoes, wind, the sun, and creeping things. He endures ill-spoken, unwelcome words, and arisen bodily feelings that are painful, racking, sharp, piercing, disagreeable, distressing, and menacing to life. While taints, vexation, and fever might arise in one who does not endure such things, there are no taints, vexation, and fever in one who endures them. These are called the taints that should be abandoned by enduring. So again, you can see here that in each case, you have this idea of reflecting wisely here. This goes throughout this thing. And it's only when you reflect wisely, and in particular that you have reflected wisely previously, so you have like a storehouse of wisdom that you can tap into, it's only then that these things actually work. So, and you will see that the more, the longer you practice the Buddhist way or these teachings, the more your ability to deal with these things. So again, you can see here, sometimes there is cold and heat, and sometimes you can't do anything about that, right? Sometimes there is hunger and thirst, and sometimes you may not be able to do anything about it. sometimes there is all these kind of problems. One important one is, of course, the ill-spoken and unwelcome words. You cannot hardly go through a day without hearing something that is a little bit kind of disagreeable, right? And then after a while you start to think, well, okay, this is just the way things are. This is the way the world works. I cannot control these things. And because you cannot control it, because there's no way you're going to be able to tell everybody off at the right time, etc., the only answer is really that you have to endure these things. This is the world, way the world is. When you understand that the world is this way, then you can accept these things much more easily. So this is really what it is about, you know, understanding the way things are. And the same thing with cold and heat. You're not always going to be able to control these things. You're not always going to be in an air-conditioned room in the height of summer. Sometimes you're going to be in the cold cutie in the monastery in the winter, etc., etc. So sometimes you just accept. You stop trying to control things. And enduring is really the opposite of controlling. You have what is needed, but sometimes you understand that enduring is the only way. And again, the last one here is the arisen bodily feelings that are painful, racking and sharp, etc. And again, this is one of the things with the body. You realize that this body is never, ever going to be completely free of problems, even for a very short period of time. There's always going to be things, you know. And you can see that in people. We're always moving our body, always moving something, always fidgeting a little bit. And basically, most of the time, it's a result. It comes as a consequence of the body never really being comfortable for very long. So again, there is some endurance to be had with bodily feeling. And this is one of the things, actually, is quite interesting in meditation practice. How much should you endure bodily feelings? And how much should you not endure? The answer to that question, I think, is you should not endure too much. Because if you endure too much, then it means that you're getting into this self-mortification, self-tormenting practice that you find in certain places. But sometimes it's good not to give in straight away either. So it's like a middle way. And when you see that your mind is becoming obsessed with the pain in the body, it goes back to the pain all the time, you can't really deal with it properly, then it's time to change your posture, to do walking meditation or whatever. And don't allow pain in the body to become like a big obstacle for yourself. It's much better to get up and do something else. Okay, so that is the pain in the body. So endurance is an important part of life. It's understanding that life has problems and you're never going to overcome them. So sometimes you just have to endure. And again, this is also about clear comprehension I was talking about before, because you understand how the world is. So because you have that clarity in your mind, when the problem arises, you say, okay, fine, let it be. Then we have avoidance, is the next one here. And it goes as follows. What taints bhikkhus should be abandoned by avoiding? Here a bhikkhu, reflecting wisely, avoids a wild elephant, a wild horse, a wild bull, a wild dog, a snake, a stump, a bramble patch, a chasm, a cliff, a cesspit, a sewer. Reflecting wisely, he avoids sitting on unsuitable seats, wandering to unsuitable resorts, and associating with bad friends, since if he were to do so, wise companions in the holy life might suspect him of evil conduct. While taints, vexation, and fever might arise in one who does not avoid these things, there are no taints, vexation, and fever in one who does avoid them. These are called the taints that should be abandoned by avoiding. So, again here, some of these may seem pretty obvious that you should avoid a wild elephant and a wild horse, etc., wild dog, snake, etc. But of course, I think in monastic life, part of this is about sometimes, you know, a monk or a nun perhaps as well might live somewhere really far away, you know, in a jungle somewhere, something like that. So it's important then to find a good location for the place that you build a kuti or a hut for yourself, in a wise place where there aren't too many dangers. So you want to avoid this sort of stuff. Otherwise, you're just going to cause trouble for yourself and for your supporters. But more importantly here, I think, is the reflecting wisely to avoid the unsuitable seats and unsuitable wandering to unsuitable resorts. And this is about basically, you know, you don't want to do things that you know are going to provoke your defilements. You know, as a monastic, you don't go to Northbridge or to a kind of nightclub area on Friday night, for example. That's not really a suitable place for a monastic. You don't go to the casino. You don't go to see the armies or the, you know, battlegrounds, these sort of things. So you stay away from places where defilements are likely to arise. So this is about going to using the right resorts. And of course, one thing here, it says unsuitable seats. Well, for a monastic, that means sitting, for example, privately with a member of the opposite gender, for example. That's an unsuitable seat. Again, you don't want to tempt fate and, you know, tempt things and test things out, so to speak, and then find out you can't really take it and then end up doing all kind of wrong things. So this is just understanding your mind, understanding how fragile it is, how easy these things arise, and how difficult it is to control it. So you don't want to tempt fate more than you have to. Sometimes people have this idea that they want to practice really hard, so they want to test themselves. But usually, in my experience, there's plenty enough of tests in life already. We don't have to seek out to test ourselves. It's hard enough as it is to practice this path. If it wasn't, we would all be arahants already. And unfortunately, that's not the case usually. So, and associating with bad friends is a similar kind of thing. A bad friend. Remember that the very famous thing the Buddha said about friendship, about kalyanamitta, good friendship. It is 100% of the living the good life, or living the monastic life, or living the good Buddhist life. 100%. And I have often thought to myself, surely it can't be serious. It's 100%. Surely it's, you know, there are other things as well that are important. But this is like a very kind of Buddhist thing. It's the understanding that when you have a teaching that talks about non-self, that there's nobody inside of you which kind of stands his or her ground and is independent of all other external conditions, when there is no self, then we are completely at the mercy of the conditions and causes around us. Everything around us influences all the time. And because we are a product of those causes and conditions, it means that the friendships that we have are 100% important for how we're going to develop. So it is 100%. So if you hang out with too many bad friends, it means that you will, at least in part, you will tend in that direction. If you hang out more with good friends, you will tend more in that direction, precisely because we are products of the things around us. So again, this is, again, you understand the danger in this. You understand how conditioned you are as a being, so you avoid that sort of conditioning. That is what is meant here. And then the last part, it says here, and this is where I think the translation is slightly faulty, it says that since, if he were to do so, wise companions in the holy life might suspect him of evil conduct. So this makes it sound as if you shouldn't do it because somebody else might suspect you of bad conduct. But the Pali actually says, according to me, this is my translation, it says that you shouldn't do these things because others might suspect you of bad conduct. This is just a statement which shows you what is meant by bad friends. So if a bad friend is anybody who a wise person says is a bad friend, or a unsuitable resort is what a wise person says is an unsuitable resort, or the last one, unsuitable seat, is what the wise person says isn't. So it defines what is an unsuitable seat by saying it's that which a wise person would feel is inappropriate, basically. That's how it defines it, just to make it very, I suppose, comprehensive in a sense. And of course, a wise person would say a place where the defilements arise, right? The Buddha always said, it's one of the, for me, one of the most useful advice that I ever read in the suttas, is that you should do in life, you should make choices that always ensures that your good qualities are increasing and your bad qualities are decreasing. That is always the right choice if you can choose between two things. Whatever increases the good quality and diminishes the bad qualities in you. So any seat which increases defilements is a bad seat, unsuitable seat. Any seat which increases wholesome states is a good seat. And the same with resorts and friendships here. A very, very useful one. So this is abandoning by avoidance. It may seem quite obvious, but even that takes quite a bit of wisdom to know how you should actually, what you should do with your life, what you should avoid and what you shouldn't. So, the three things that we've just been looking at now, which is the abandoning by using, abandoning by enduring, and abandoning by avoiding, all of these three, they revolve around this thing called clear comprehension, sampajanya, understanding things, what is suitable, what is purposeful. That is what they revolve around. So these are, as I understand this, these are here in place of the normal passage of clear comprehension that you find in the gradual training. So this is like an expanded version of that. It shows you how clear comprehension works in practice. You understand what the dangers are, and then you avoid those, you endure, and you use things appropriately. Okay, so is everybody happy with that? Does it make sense so far? I'm going quite slowly here, but I always find these things very useful. These are very practical things. These are things we all can use in our lives. So because of that, it's nice to go through these things slowly, I feel. So I hope you... Can you, everybody follow me what I'm saying here? Yeah? Okay, great. Yeah. So please, again, if you have a question, please just raise your hand. So now we come towards the end of the sutta, the last two ways of abandoning the taints. And the next one is called the abandoning by removing. And the Buddha says here, and what taints, bhikkhus, should be abandoned by removing? Here a bhikkhu, reflecting wisely, does not tolerate an arisen thought of sensual desire. He abandons it, removes it, does away with it, and annihilates it. He does not tolerate an arisen thought of ill will. He does not tolerate an arisen thought of cruelty. He does not tolerate arisen evil, unwholesome qualities. He abandons them, removes them, does away with them, and annihilates them. While taints, vexation, and fever might arise in one who does not remove these thoughts, there are no taints, vexations, or fever in one who removes them. These are called the taints that should be abandoned by removing. So this is about removing things that have arisen in the mind that are unwholesome. And one of the interesting things here is that, which may look strange on the surface, the first thing we started with this afternoon was we looked at restraining, right? Restraining means that you avoid bad thoughts from arising. And only now comes the removing after the restraining. Now, perhaps you would think that surely the removing should come first and then the restraining, right? Because you have to abandon them before you can really restrain it. That seems to be a natural sequence here. At least for me, it seems natural. I think you probably understand what I'm talking about. So what is going on here? How come the restraining comes before the removing? It seems like counterintuitive. And the reason for that, I think, because this is a very standard way, you find it throughout the suttas, that it goes into this sequence. Usually, what you find, instead of removing the three kinds of bad thoughts, you find removing the five hindrances. That's usually what you find at this place. But the sense restraint is exactly the same. The sequence is always the same. And what is going on here is that the restraining that's happening first is really the restraining of quite coarse things in your mind. It's restraining like strong desires or ill will or strong defilements that arise in the mind. And once you have restrained that, then, only then, is it really possible to abandon the defilements fully. And this is what is happening here. So first of all, you restrain things so that there are only weak defilements left in the mind. And when there are only weak defilements left, then is it possible to actually abandon them. And the reason for that, and you see this throughout the suttas, the Buddha says that if you have anger or you have desire in your mind is distorted. You can't see clearly. Because you think that something needs to be done which doesn't need to be done. You think you have to have this thing because the desire is there. It distorts the mind. And when the desire is gone or the anger is gone, you realize that the mind at that time was completely distorted. It was turned upside down. It's called the vipalasa in Pali, the distortions of the mind. And it is very hard to understand how powerful these distortions are. They really turn the mind completely upside down sometimes. You do things which really are crazy when you're overcome powerfully by these defilements. So because of that, it is usually impossible to remove anger once it has arisen. Right? If you really feel angry, how easy is it to remove it? Very, very hard, because it's a very powerful feeling inside of you. And very often all you have to do is like wait. Try not to feed it, try not to make it worse, and wait for it to calm down again. Maybe use a little bit of good thinking here, but very often there isn't that much you can do once it has arisen. So the only type of defilement you can remove is a very weak defilement, when there's a little bit of irritation, perhaps, or a little bit of, you know, very weak form of desire, or, you know, something like that. That is the point when you can remove the unwholesome states of mind. And this is the reason for this sequence. First of all, you restrain the defilements that are very strong, and only then does the time come for removing, which is here. And this removing, as I mentioned before, usually at this point, it talks about the five hindrances. So this is just an alternative way of looking at the five hindrances. It is not as detailed as the five hindrances, but it's roughly the same kind of thing here. And the five hindrances are also removed at this particular point. How do you actually do that? And one way of doing that you find in the suttas, one of the most powerful ways, is, of course, meditation practice itself. Meditation, you know, whether it's watching the breath or it is satipatthana practice, whatever it is, the purpose of that meditation is precisely to abandon these kind of defilements. So that is the purpose of satipatthana, is actually to abandon defilements and then to bring the mind together and then take you to samadhi, to sammasamadhi or the jhanas, the very deep meditation states. That is the purpose of satipatthana as it is explained in the suttas again and again and again. So that is the point here. So this is basically about, you know, watching the breath or doing some other satipatthana practice to abandon these things. That is what is actually meant by this practice here, in large part. So, you have here, again, the reflecting wisely. And you will see in this case, he has a very strong wording. He says here that you do not tolerate these thoughts. You abandon them, you remove them, you do away with them, you annihilate them. So I think this is both within meditation, but perhaps also outside of meditation, if you have a sufficient mindfulness about you. But certainly in meditation, when you sit down and you meditate and you see a thought about to arise, which is no good, what do? You annihilate it, as it says here. But again, that annihilation is based on wisdom, reflecting wisely, having reflected wisely. You know this is dangerous. You have understood this from your past practice. So straight away, when this is about to arise, mindfulness reminds you of the danger, and because that understanding is there, it disappears, it's annihilated. That is what it meant by annihilation. Wisdom annihilates these things when you understand the danger in them. So here it comes again, the same idea of using wisdom rather than using willpower. And you can see here, it's very easy to think that this might refer to willpower. You don't tolerate it, right? You do away with it, you annihilate it. But actually, real annihilation happens precisely through wisdom, because wisdom is so powerful. So you have the ill will, you have the sensual desire, which is the desire towards the objects of the five senses, right? Sensual desire in Buddhism is about any desire you have in relation to seeing, hearing, touching, smelling, and tasting. That sensual desire here. And lastly, you have the cruelty, it says here. The Pali is vihinsa or hinsa. And this word means basically like harming, you know, not really being callous, being hard-hearted, not caring about creatures. The opposite of compassion. Ruthlessness might be one translation. Being inconsiderate might be another translation. I think cruelty is a bit too strong. Harming is a translation that Bhikkhu Bodhi uses in his most recent translations. So this is then the removing, and this happens mostly through meditation practice. That is a time when you actually abandon these things completely. Okay, so that is the sixth method here in the Sabbasava Sutta. And now we come to the last one, This is a very interesting one, and I will only have time, I think, to go through this in fairly superficially, but this is the abandoning by developing, and this is the development of the seven factors of awakening, which is meant here by developing. But before I do that, I want to maybe have another look at how this whole sequence so far matches up with the Noble Eightfold Path. So you can see here how at the beginning you have the right view, which it starts off with, which is the abandoning the taints by seeing. It's the right view you have to begin with. Then I said it skips all the virtue factors of the Noble Eightfold Path, including right intention, because that is kind of subsumed under the fact that you are supposed to be a stream enter according to this sutta. Then you come to right effort, which is the restraint of the senses, and this sampajanya, the clear comprehension that we've been looking at all the way through here. Then, once you have right effort, you get right mindfulness. And right mindfulness is precisely the satipatthana practice. And that is what is meant here by removing the last passage we just went through here. And once you have removed those hindrances completely through satipatthana, which includes breath meditation, anapanasati, then the last step of the path is samadhi, sammasamadhi, the four jhanas. So you can expect that the last part here is about developing the four jhanas. And that is what you will see actually is the case. And of course, one of the interesting things is that here, like in so many other places, the path ends with the four jhanas. You know, very often you will hear that once you've gotten to the four jhanas, you have to do insight meditation and all these things, and that this is an important part of the practice. But it's very fascinating that in the suttas, the path normally ends with the jhanas, with samadhi. So how can that be? How can the path end with jhana? And the reason is that once you have these deep states of samadhi, once you have that, and it also, second factor is very important, and it is based on right view. Remember, it starts off with right view. Once you have that, then the insight happens by itself. And you see this in the suttas again and again and again. It says that for one who has samadhi, he doesn't need to think, may I see things in accordance with reality? It is in accordance to nature that one who has samadhi, he will see things in accordance with reality. You don't need to think that. So if you have samadhi, which is based on right view, sammasamadhi, then the rest happens by itself. It's a very important point because, you know, you will hear all these things about, you know, I mean, there's many different viewpoints about these things, but the very fact that samadhi comes last, I think, is something which is very often overlooked. And that, basically, that is how far the path goes, and it doesn't go beyond that. The rest is automatic. So just for your... just to make that point before I start off with this. Okay, so then we come to these factors of awakening here, and it goes as follows. What taints, bhikkhus, should be abandoned by developing? Here, a bhikkhu, reflecting wisely, develops the mindfulness enlightenment factor, which is supported by seclusion, dispassion, and cessation, and ripens in relinquishment. He develops the investigation of states enlightenment factor, the energy enlightenment factor, the rapture enlightenment factor, the tranquility enlightenment factor, the samadhi enlightenment factor, or concentration it has here, the equanimity enlightenment factor. And all of these are supported by seclusion, dispassion, and cessation, and they all ripen in relinquishment. While taints and vexation and fever might arise in one who does not develop these enlightenment factors, there are no taints, vexation, or fever in one who develops them. These are called the taints that should be abandoned by developing here. So here you have the seven factors of awakening. I prefer awakening to enlightenment. And of course, this is one of the standard sets that you find in the suttas. And this is what is then developed at this point. And you will notice here that you have just abandoned the five hindrances in the previous paragraph, and the seven awakening factors are like the development that happens of the mind after the hindrances are gone. These are like almost like antonyms. You have the negative states, and then you have the positive states. So once you have abandoned the hindrances, then you start empowering the mind through these enlightenment factors. So these are like almost the opposites of the hindrances. And the first one here is the mindfulness enlightenment factor. So what does that mean? And what this means basically is that your mindfulness is properly established. You are in the present moment. You are clear about what's going on. At that point, your mindfulness factor is established. And the way it is often used in the suttas is that one of the ways it is used is that you recollect things like the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, for example, or generosity or virtue in your life. And when you do that recollection, because the mindfulness is there, then these other enlightenment factors that come afterwards, they get a kind of they get awakened, or they arise in you as a consequence of that. So you remember that. That is the mindfulness awakening factor. And then you reflect about the Buddha, for example, or you reflect about your generosity in the past. That is like the investigation. And then when that investigation works properly, then the energy and the rapture arise together. This is the piti, and the energy is the virya in Pali. These arise they always arise together as a consequence because of that reflection that you're doing here. So these come up together. So this is one way in which the mindfulness enlightenment factor is there. You remember, you recollect something from the past. One meaning of mindfulness is recollection, remembering from the past. The other way that it works is that you are doing satipatthana practice. Satipatthana is like samma sati, right? Right mindfulness. So you're doing satipatthana practice. And the last factor of the satipatthana practice is you have the four satipatthanas. The last one is the dhammanupassana. Now, dhamma here, that particular dhammanupassana, as has been argued by some scholars, is that that mainly means investigation of the five hindrances and investigation of the seven bhojangas. An investigation of them means understanding them, understanding how they arise, understanding how they cease, understanding how they don't cease again in the future, and how once arisen they remain. That is understanding these things. In other words, you understand the causality behind these things. And that is what is meant then by the investigation here, the second factor. You have the mindfulness through satipatthana practice, and you have the investigation of states. Investigation of states means investigating what is unwholesome, what is wholesome, how these things arise, how they cease. And then through that investigation, you overcome the last remnant of defilement that might still be in your mind. And once everything is overcome, that is when rapture and energy arises in the mind. It is the defilements that sap the mind of energy. It is the defilements that make you have no gladness and piti and happiness. So once they are abandoned, these things come all by themselves. So this is how the seven bhojangas kind of get started. They get started through mindfulness, through the practice of the previous factor here, and then these things start to take over of their own accord, so to speak. So the energy arises, the rapture arises, these often come together. The rapture is like the very strong feeling of pleasure, very often felt in the body that you can get in meditation. When you get very peaceful, you can often feel a strong sense of pleasure inside of you. It often feels like it's almost coursing through the body, perhaps, or something like that. And this is the rapture, the piti. And then, once you get this thing process started, and this is where we're talking here about really a process of meditation at this point, once it gets started, all you have to do is basically sit there and continue watching the breath or whatever it is, and the process will tend to move on by itself. So from that rapture that you have in the body, you then get tranquility. The rapture starts to die down and calm down. It becomes more refined, and you feel a strong sense of peace and tranquility. And this is the next factor here. And when that tranquility becomes very deep, then happiness arises and concentration, samadhi, comes as a consequence of that. Because the point is, at this point, you are so contented, you're so happy, you don't want to go anywhere else. And that is what concentration or samadhi means. It means the mind staying completely in the here and now, not wanting to move anywhere else because the present moment is so beautiful, right? So tranquility, pleasure of the mind, this is what is happening at this particular point. So this you can see here, that what we are seeing here is in a sense the psychology of meditation practice. You can see how the mind changes step by step. You start off with mindfulness, and when mindfulness is strong, you also have the energy, and then with that energy there's a sense of gladness, the rapture comes. This is actually what's happening to you personally as you're meditating. The rapture comes, the tranquility comes, the happiness comes, and the mind starts to become very unified and very powerfully concentrated in samadhi. This is the process as it goes through. And the deeper that samadhi is, the more pure the mind is, until you get to the stage where you have complete equanimity. This is the last of the seven enlightenment or awakening factors, equanimity. Where the mind is completely neutral. There's no more happiness, there's no more suffering, there's nothing at all. It's just pure, pure kind of balance of mind. All happiness has been left behind. It's one of the paradoxes of the Dhamma, which I always find very fascinating, is that equanimity, where the feeling of happiness has disappeared, is a more happy state than the state where there's happiness. Isn't that interesting? You'd think that if you had the most powerful happiness that is available, like in the early jhanas, you think that that must surely be the happiest you can ever be. But actually, when you get rid of the happiness, you're even more happy. It's the paradox of happiness. The less there is, the more refined things are, the more happy you are in a certain way. Not because the feeling itself is happy, but simply because it is experienced as more satisfying. That is the enlightenment factors. And of course, these enlightenment factors have many different strengths to them. At the very weakest, the piti is just like the ordinary rapture you can feel in the body as your meditation starts to deepen. But in a deeper stage, the piti is like the piti of the jhanas themselves, because the jhanas also have piti in them. And this is true for all these enlightenment factors. They get deeper and deeper as you keep practicing them. And that is how you gradually move towards full awakening. And then they culminate in the equanimity, which is the fourth jhana, which of course is also where the Noble Eightfold Path culminates. It culminates in the fourth jhana as well. So that's where they're all going to. So that is the things that you abandon by developing. And what you are abandoning here by developing this is ultimately all the defilements, all the root defilements, until you attain the full awakening, the arahantship that the Buddhist spiritual path promises you. So there's one more thing which I haven't discussed here, which I probably should discuss briefly here. And that is that it says that these factors are supported by seclusion, dispassion, and cessation, and they ripen in relinquishment. So what does it mean that they are supported by seclusion, dispassion, and cessation? Well, they are supported by seclusion in the sense that these are the sort of things which are so profound that they only start to happen once you start to meditate on your own, apart from the world, completely secluded from the world around you. It also means that seclusion here also means that the mind is secluded from the defilements. So not just physical seclusion, but also that your mind is pure. These things are called the kaya viveka and the chitta viveka. Kaya viveka is seclusion of the body, chitta viveka is seclusion of the mind. The mind is secluded from the defilements, and the body is secluded from society, so to speak. So this shows you that this solitude is very important for meditation to become really profound. Then we have dispassion and cessation. A translation which might be more satisfying in this context than dispassion is perhaps fading away. This is viraga, is the word, Pali word here. It can be in both dispassion and fading away. And fading away and dispassion are very closely related to each other, because when you start to become dispassionate to something, it fades away from your mind, right? So fading away and dispassion are very closely linked to each other. So what we are talking about here, when we talk about fading away and cessation, is all the things that happen in meditation up to this point are fading away. The body is fading away and then ceasing. The five senses are fading away and ceasing. The hindrances are fading away and ceasing. You find that things like the rapture starts to become more refined. It starts to fade away and cease in the higher jhanas. So what this is about is you can actually see, as you move along in meditation, things become more and more simplified. Things start to end. And that is one of the supports for this whole process to actually work. And that's why the deep samadhi, almost the whole world has ceased as we know it now. The senses are gone, the hindrances are gone, the body has disappeared. And your perception is very, very simple compared to the perception that we have in ordinary life. So this is what is meant here, is the gradual cessation that happens through the process of meditation. And then it ripens in relinquishment. And relinquishment means that you are giving things up. You're giving up the five khandhas. You understand that things are suffering. Giving up means not having craving, right? If you have craving or attachment, that's holding on. This is the opposite of craving attachment. You relinquish it. You let it go. You don't hold on to it anymore. So this is the final stage. If you keep practicing this, the final stage is you relinquish it all. You give it all up. And then you become an arahant. You reach full awakening at that particular point. So, there you are. That is the full path explained in the Sabhasava Sutta. And there's a lot of material here. I hope I haven't completely kind of run you down with massive amounts of information. It's quite easy for me to say these things because I know these things quite well, obviously. And sometimes I forget how much information it actually is to take in. But don't be too concerned about that. Take in the things that you can take in. If you feel it's too much, you just come back later on and gradually the picture will start to gel for you. You start to see how this works. Anyway, let's go to the conclusion aspect, the very last passage of the sutta. Bhikkhus, when for a bhikkhu the taint that should be abandoned by seeing have been abandoned by seeing, when the taints that should be abandoned by restraining have been abandoned by restraining, when the taints that should be abandoned by using have been abandoned by using, when the taints that should be abandoned by enduring have been abandoned by enduring, when the taints that should be abandoned by avoiding have been abandoned by avoiding, when the taints that should be abandoned by removing have been abandoned by removing, and when the taints that should be abandoned by developing have been abandoned by developing, then he is called a bhikkhu who dwells restrained with the restraint of all the taints. He has severed craving, flung off the fetters, and with a complete penetration of conceit, he has made an end of suffering. So just very briefly, just comment on that last line there so that it's clear what's going on. He has severed craving. In other words, he has made an end of craving, flung off the fetters. flung off is interesting. The fetters are the things that bind you to existence, right? That bind you to samsara. So that's why they're called fetters, because they are bindings. And these things are the things that, you know, like sense desire, ill will, doubt, personality view, sakaya ditti, etc. These are the things that bind you to existence. And these are talked about odd places in the sutta. I'm not going to go into it much more. And the complete penetration of conceit. Conceit here just means, in Buddhism, doesn't mean conceit in the normal way we think of conceit. It means the idea I. As long as you have the idea I am, I, there is conceit. That is what is called conceit in Buddhism. Conceit is not a very good translation, but I think it's very hard to find satisfactory translations for this. But it means the sense you have inside of me, of I. That's conceit. So once you have let go of all that, you have made a complete end of suffering. You are an arahant. That is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So, any last questions before we call it a day here? Everybody happy here? Clear? Absolutely, yeah, crystal clear, yeah. Okay, yeah. There's a lot of information there. It would have been good if we had the copies, but because I just came in, I wasn't able to do the copies beforehand, unfortunately. Yeah. So that's the way it goes. Yes, happy? Yes, okay, please, sir. Satipatthana. Well, there is a whole sutta on Satipatthana in this collection here. This is the middle length sayings, and the 10th sutta in this collection is all about Satipatthana practice. But Satipatthana is quite an involved area, and if you really want to study it in detail, you're going to have to, you know, probably good to listen to talks on the internet about Satipatthana, because it's quite involved. And just by reading it, you're likely to get a very superficial view of it. Okay, so everybody seems happy, so let's pay our respects.